image of what this is. I don't know why.
Really very interesting. Anyway, so what I'm going to talk about is some paper I wrote with my student Itai Nachshon. It's all these names. And it's kind of an old paper. It's 2.5 years ago, and I always find the need to apologize. So there's a first. I did other things since then, but somehow I really like this one, so I want to talk about it. And the other, we still have a work in progress on it, and we go very slowly, so I always have this excuse whenever I give this talk. So what I want to show is the following. So hopefully soon, we all hope so, the LHC will find new particles, okay? We're not 100% sure, but that's at least our working assumption. And what we're going to do then, okay, we find a new particle. So the first thing, of course, you know, everybody going to celebrate. But what we really want to do is we want to measure all the properties. And the more properties you have, the better you are, right? And so what we want to do, for example, we want to measure the mass of the particle. How, that's, I say, relatively simple, because basically, you know, there's many ideas. You just look at the invariant mass of this, what, this new particle decay. You find what it is, and you know what the mass of the dot, of the, you know, the mother particle. Another one is the spin, and that's much of a harder problem, but it's a problem many people have been worked on. And the basic idea is that when you have some particle with some spin, you, the decay product has some angular correlations. Okay? So the basic idea is that when you have some spin and some polarization, the decay product has some angular distribution. Okay, so that's the basic idea of how do we measure spins. Okay? Of course, it depends on a lot of details, but we hope that we can do it. We would like, for example, to measure the charge of the particle. We would like to move the electric charge. It might not be trivial if this particle is, for example, colored. So if it's kind of a lepton, then it should be kind of trivial. But if it's have some color, then it shouldn't be so trivial. Okay. SU3 charge, that's relatively easy. Clearly, probably the easiest things to do is to tell if it's a singlet or non-singlet of SU3. If you just produce jets or not. But actually, we hope to do more. We can say maybe it's an octet, and that you can do, but, you know, an octet have more charge. And the question what I really like to talk about is the lifetime. And how do we measure lifetimes? But I think the bottom line is the more we determine, the better we are. We just want to do more. Okay? We just want to know everything about the new particle. So how do we measure lifetime? There's basically two ways to measure lifetime. Okay? And one way is to measure the width. So if the particle lives really, really short time, the width is large enough and you can measure the width. However, if the width of the particle is smaller than some experimental sensitivity, you will not be able to measure the width. And what is the experimental sensitivity? Do we have any experimentalists here? No. The place without. But roughly speaking,
any number, I believe
you. Yeah, that's right. You know, roughly speaking, we talk about a 1 GeV. So it's very much depend on what is the final state, of course. You know, if you have jets and missing energy, it's much harder because, you know, this jet energy scales there. Problem and you don't really very easy to reconstruct the jet. And of course, if you have a decay that is purely leptonic and you measure all the leptons, all charged lepton, you can do better. But roughly speaking, we talk about 1 GeV. Okay? If the width is much, much smaller than 1 GeV, no way we can measure it. Okay? Just the experimental width will be much larger than the quantum mechanics width. Okay? So for particle with very short lifetime, you can measure the width. That's one way to measure the lifetime. The other way to measure the lifetime is to use displaced vertex. And what is the idea here? The idea here is that the particle lives relatively long, and then you produce it at one point, and it's travel, and it decay at another point, just like we do with B physics, right? So the way we identify B meson is that they produce here, and they decay there, and then you measure how much they travel. And of course, you know, it depends also on the gamma factor, etc. But usually what we think about new particle, we think about the new particle have some mass of order 100, 200, 300 GeV. So the gamma factor is usually not a very big factor, okay? And you cannot get a gamma factor of 1,000,000 to make the, okay? So basically the point is that, so maybe, very roughly, it should work when the lifetime is like a picosecond, roughly speaking. Okay, depend on the details. And a picosecond is roughly 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. So if the lifetime is longer than a picosecond, then basically the particle can kind of travel long enough that we can see. We don't really have to see the fact that it's travel. We just have to see the fact that when you reconstruct the tracks coming out, it doesn't point into the primary vertex. Okay? The point is, these two methods are very well known. Okay? That there's kind of a window that we cannot probe, and this window is kind of a large window. If the width is roughly between 10 to the minus 4 electron volt to 1 GeV, we basically cannot measure the lifetime of the particle. Okay? That's the point. So the question, and that's really what this talk is about, can we do anything about this window? Okay? Yes?
So suppose it has not long enough to live in the space vertex, but a little longish. How long, like how many such decays would you need to see to start seeing the tail and being able to extrapolate?
Yeah, just the statistics, right? So you say any lifetime you wait, you lose another 1 over E, right? So, I mean, to get a factor of 10, it's E to the 10 events, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. The other problem is that the tails, the real reconstruction tails are polynomial, and the physics tail is exponential. So in practice, you know, you can't see the one left thing, the one big tail left thing. You're pretty much toast.
Well, you will see the, you do see the decay. You see all the decays. You just see some of them do live in space vertex.
Right. I'm just saying that, like, the non-Gaussian tails and Proksch decays are sort of power law things. So unless you work really hard to tame that, that falls slower than your exponential physical.
So at the end of the day, the point is that, you know, we have a large window, and I don't care exactly what this window is, but it's very clear that we have kind of a problem that on this window. We cannot measure lifetime. If the lifetime of the new particle sit there, we cannot measure it. And of course, we like to. Yes?
From a model-building point of view, how likely is it to be in that?
Oh, I always love this kind of question because that's the next transparency, okay? So it's like you said before, okay? So I will get there in a second. But the answer, so the question I ask in this, yes?
Well, I was going to ask you, is this a problem specific just to LHC or like, overcome this? I mean, it seems like a generic problem with, you know, sort of colliders.
Yeah.
You have a collider scale. It's a meter
to
10 meters or something.
That's right. It's a generic problem. And actually, one of the things I didn't know, that actually the pi zero width had been measured. And the pi zero width is actually like a KeV. Okay, the lifetime is 10 to the minus 16 seconds. I think it's 1 EV, maybe a 1 EV. But it's definitely within this window. But the point is that, you know, it's somewhat different setup. And pi zeros, you produce at much lower energy, and it's a different. But it's true. This kind of thing is always a problem. Why we didn't bother with it until now? Because all our particles are in I. So
pi zero is the only particle?
Yes. Yes. If you look on all these resonances, like rho and all these, they are wide enough. If you have QCD decays, they are wide enough. If they're weak decay, they're narrow enough. The only one that we actually don't know is the top. Okay, we really didn't measure the lifetime of the top. So while we all know that it should be like 2 GeV, we didn't measure it. Okay, and there might be some new physics there. Very unlikely, but it's not a... Okay, but basically, if it's QCD, it's large enough. If it's weak decay, it's small enough. So somehow nature was kind or non-kind to us, that the decay that we have is either weak or strong, and they like certain order of magnitude between themselves that this window never realized. Okay, so that's...
It's just because the mass scale of the particle...
That's right. So it just... There's no fundamental reason not to be in this window, and it's a pi zero is the one that is in this window and that people had been measured. But basically, all other particles are either here or there. So maybe the future will be still the same. But you see, the question I like to ask, I want a method to measure it, okay, as a principle, okay? So what I want to tell you, so the question I'm asking in this talk is, can we do something about this window? And the answer is, and I want to put all these disclaimers, okay, in some cases, we can do something, okay? So that's mean that in some cases we can do nothing, okay? And basically in this talk, all I'm going to consider is only one case that we can do something, and that's the case where the new particle is a quark-like new particle. It's a color single, it's a color triplet and a spin half. Okay, that's the only case I'm going to consider, and I'm not going to tell you that in principle that we can measure the lifetime. All I'm going to tell you that, roughly speaking, I can tell you, take this window of 13 order of magnitude and divide it into three. And I can tell you that the lifetime is either in this one, two, or three part of the window. Okay? So I'm not claiming that I'm solved the problem of how to measure lifetime in this window. I said that in one case, I can divide this window into three. Okay? So the expectation, I already kind of lowered the expectation. But the way I'm doing it is some very cute quantum mechanics that I'm going to explain. Okay? That's the point. So, that's coming back to your question. Is this problematic region even problematic? Because, you know, you just ask from a model building point of view, you say, oh, it's not there. Because if I ask you, give me a model, what would be the naive lifetime? You say the naive lifetime is some two-body decay, and two-body decay has the lifetime is some alpha m. And if m is something like 200 GeV, and alpha, if it's alpha weak or something, 0.3, 0.4, 0.6, I don't know. You know, so if alpha strong is 0.2, if it's alpha weak, it's still like, it's still much larger than 1 GeV. And indeed, if you do kind of look in all the SUSY literature, all these lifetimes are few GeVs. Okay, so if you ask, give me a gluino, what is the lifetime of your gluino in whatever SUSY model? Usually the answer is few GeV, right? So maybe it's not a problem. Another part, some other kinds of particles are actually, we say, oh, this particle don't decay at alpha m. They might be stable because there's like R parity or T parity or whatever parity you want to impose. So when you do model building, you find that most of the cases, your particle either decay naively very fast or there's some symmetry that make them decay very long. And then nothing really falls inside the problematic region. So in a way, people also didn't talk too much about this problematic region because not only that nature so far never falls in the problematic region, also model building usually don't lead you to the problematic region. Okay. However, what I want to say that there's really two reasons why we do care about this problematic region. And the first one is probably the good answer. The answer is that I don't care about model building. I want a way to measure lifetime independent of, you know, you can do model building from here until infinity. That doesn't mean that you're going to find the true model of nature, right? So we want to make a way to do it just because it's interesting to see how you measure it. Okay? So that's the answer. The other answer is that actually there are models that predict it. Okay? Actually, I think Itai have one model that has some particle in this, right? Some zip, in the Z prime, SUSY breaking, you have one particle? Yeah. I think you gave a talk at Cornell, and I think when he gave the talk at Cornell, he said, that's a problem because this particle is in this problematic region. Okay? So actually, Itai has, yes?
There's maybe a third point. It's just that, you know, in all weak decays, the tau happens to have a short, long enough lifetime just because MW is a little smaller. But, you know, if MW was a factor of 3 larger or a factor of 10 larger, as you expect in new physics, the lifetime is much more shorter.
Yes.
So generically, any kind of weak decay is with slightly bigger W prime.
Yeah, you can have it. And so the point is that there are models on the market that do it, okay? It's not, like, completely unheard of. It's just the naive models are... But what I'm going to... So what I really want to think that got like MeV widths or KV widths. And the point, you know, there are models, you know, you can have like in split SUSY, for some reason you take the intermediate particle heavy enough and it's... Okay, so there is models that give it...
For example, that's the one you mentioned, that the W plus minus, the gluino plus minus is slightly split in
And you have some small parameter that is splitting. But, okay, what I want to say is that the question I'm asking is, let's assume I find this new particle for this specific one, how can I do? Okay, so that's really a kind of setting up the question. So, let's talk about time scales. And, you know, the more you do physics, the more you understand it. Understanding time scale is, like, so fundamental. It's, like, so important to understand what time scales are. So, you know, with time scale or distance scale or energy scale, it's all the same. So the basic idea of how I'm going to measure lifetime is using the following idea, okay? So we need some other time scale that is in the problematic region, clearly, right? Because if all my time scale that I can do is not in the problematic region, I will never be able to probe it. So let's assume that I have some what I call approximate quantum number, okay? And this approximate quantum number, it's conserved over some time that I call TR for relaxation time. Okay, so I produce some state, and this state is not, it's not a good symmetry, but this state has some quantum number, and this quantum number, at very short time, it's still there, and after a very long time, this it's kind of disappear. Okay? And the quantum number we're going to think about is some polarization. Okay, that matters. There's many, the idea is very general. You have to think about something that you produce with a non-quantum number, and after some time, TR, it's the, I don't have this quantum number anymore. So if the lifetime is much, much smaller than this relaxation time, basically this quantum number is conserved. I produce the particle decay, and practically this quantum number is conserved. Okay? If, however, the lifetime is much, much longer than this relaxation time, then this quantum number is not conserved. Okay? And more generally, the probability of this quantum number to survive is some exponential. It has to do with okay, so if you look for some ensemble of particles that you produce with the same quantum number and you measure the quantum number at the end, you say how much survive is some exponential, the ratio of these time scales. Okay? So the basic idea is as following. I want to measure this P, which is how much of this quantum number survive, and I know to calculate the relaxation time. So if I can calculate the relaxation time and measure how much of this quantum number survive, I will get the lifetime, okay? This idea is kind of the whole kind of trivial idea. It's clear? Okay, good.
How is the lifetime related to
this? The lifetime is tau. And I say, I measure this quantum number when the particle decay. I should have said it, okay? So I produce the particle with some quantum number, and the decay of the particle measure this quantum number, okay? So I look at the decay time and I say, is this quantum number survive or not, okay? Actually, that would be ideally. Yeah. What I'm going to tell you soon is that this quantum number is the polarization. So, you know, if you have some particle in a magnetic field, for example, and you produce a particle with spin up in a magnetic field. So, of course, if the magnetic field is very weak, it still stays spin up for a very long time. If it's a very strong magnetic field, it loses polarization extremely fast because it starts rotating in the magnetic field, right? So the question is, how this kind of rotation time in the magnetic field compared to the lifetime. If the lifetime is much smaller than the rotation time, you see I produce spin up, it's still spin up. If the rotation time, if it's rotated many, many times, produce spin up, on average I see no net polarization because it's loose polarization. Okay? This idea is, this kind of analog is clear. That's the whole idea. You have to look for something that the time that it's taken to disappear is somewhere in the problematic region, and then you can tell it happened before its decay or after its decay, this disappearing. Okay? So I don't measure the lifetime directly. I measure the lifetimes through this kind of knowing if these things survive or not. So I don't know, that's probably coming from flavor physics. That's the example I came about, but there's many other examples. But that's the example I like to do. Okay, so let's consider a world. So, you know, maybe here, maybe it's a good idea to remind what we know about the meson mixing. So in BB bar mixing, for example, we measure very precise the oscillation time, and we don't really know how to calculate delta m. There's some theoretical uncertainty in calculating delta m. So in the standard, you know, in everyday life, what we do, we have a measurement of delta m, and from this measurement of delta m, we extract the calculation of you know, CKM parameter. Okay, that's now consider actually a world where things would be very different. We will not be able to measure the B lifetime. In real world, we measure the B lifetime. But theorists were smart enough to calculate delta M. And I say, if in a world that I cannot measure gamma, and I know delta M, how can I measure gamma from knowing delta M? Okay? So we look for the integrated oscillation probability, what we call Sensine D lepton. And this Sensine lepton really measures delta M over gamma. And if you think about what does it mean that it measures delta M over gamma, delta M just is the oscillation frequency, and gamma is when it's decay. Okay? So when it oscillates very fast, basically you get 50%, you know, 50% of UB become a B bar. If it oscillates very slow, you produce a B, this B stay a B. Okay? So the measurement of this delta M over gamma is actually tells you how much same sign D lepton you have, how many Bs go into B bar. Okay? So in this world, I can use the theory of delta M and the measurement of delta M over gamma to extract gamma. Okay? So that's the basic idea. You have some quantum number. This quantum number is B flavor, and the relaxation time is delta M. Okay? Roughly. That's when I start with a known B, take delta M until it's oscillated into a B bar. Okay? So that's the basic idea. Okay, so back to the LHC. In our case, what I want to see is that the quantum number is polarization. So I assume that I can produce some particle with known polarization, so say spin up. And the point is that in the problematic region, the width is smaller than lambda QCD, roughly. So all these color particles hadronize, okay? Now, when you produce a particle with spin up, like a lepton, it will stay spin up forever until it's decay, okay? But if you produce, say, a top with spin up, and this top hadronizes, hadronization actually kind of kill the polarization, okay? And I'm going to explain it in detail. It's really the hyperfine splitting. So what I want you to think about is then I produce a top, and this top hadronizes, the hadronization somehow kind of depolarizes the top. Okay, I'm going to explain it. And there's basically two timescale. There's the two timescale that we're going to talk about is the two timescale that between the two hyperfine splitting and the decay. So there's actually two timescale, not only one. There's two timescale in the problematic region that make you lose polarization. Okay, so you start with, say, 100% polarized, and after some time scale, you become 50% polarized, and after another time scale, you become non-polarized at all. So I'm going to explain it, but that's the basic idea. Yes? So
maybe we'll experiment, but is it essentially because when you dress it up with quark anti-quark, you create very strong magnetic fields?
Kind of, yeah. I'm going to explain it now in detail. That's kind of the nice quantum mechanics that's going on, okay? And it just turned out, and probably there was one more place I should have changed this setting. Anyway, so these time scales, so I take a top and I say, I had a gauge that I can change VTB, and change the lifetime of the top, okay? And I get hadronization. It just turned out that for a top like quark particle, these two timescales that I was telling you just happen to be in the problematic region. It doesn't have to be the case. We're just lucky us that it's happened, okay? So I want to explain what are these two timescales and how we calculate and how we see that they are in the problematic region. Okay? Very good. So back to first grade, the hydrogen atom. That's my son when he was a first grader. He's now a 10th grader. And it's kind of the story. So I always say back to first grade, hydrogen atom, because I don't know, I learned the hydrogen atom, but I think I never really appreciate how good the hydrogen atom is until I was teaching quantum mechanics. And then you see, like, so much in the hydrogen atom, like so many things that later on, oh, yeah, it's just the hydrogen atom, okay? Anyway, so that's my son. Now he takes chemistry in high school, and he came back home after, you know, I always tell him about the hydrogen atom. So he came back home. And he said, you know what my teacher told me? He told me that for the hydrogen atom, the Bohr model is exact. And I said, oh, my God, you know, Dan, you don't believe me. I tell you the Schrödinger equation every day over dinner. So anyway, they learn in school that that's what it is. There's no... So let's go back to what they should have learned in school rather than the... No, the Bohr model is interesting, but, you know, when you teach it, remember always to say it's only a model, it's not. So let's come back to hyperfine splitting, and I'm sure all of you learn it, but maybe some of you is a little bit, you don't really refresh it recently. So let's come back to hyperfine splitting, and it's like, really, undergrad physics now, forget about LHC, forget about everything, just recalling the hydrogen atom, okay? So what is the hyperfine splitting? The hyperfine splitting is actually, we use the fact that the proton is much, much heavier than the electron, and we look for the spin-spin interaction between the proton and the electron in the hydrogen atom, okay? And naively, you say the ground state of the electron have two states, which is the spin up and spin down of the electron. Now you say, oh, actually, there's four states there because the proton has spin up, spin down, and the electron has spin up, spin down. So I have four states. Okay? And what are these two states? We say, oh, these two states are just half times half. So that's 0 plus 1. So I have a triplet and a singlet. Okay? So the ground state of the hydrogen atom that is degenerate in the limit that m proton go to infinity. So in the limit that m proton go to infinity, the ground state is degenerate, and I have the two states are the same. When I took the fact that the proton has spin off and it's finite mass, you find that you split it into these two hyperfine, the spin zero and the spin half. Okay? Sorry, the spin zero and the spin one. And we call it the singlet and the triplet. And
it's, yes.
That's the 21. That's the next line I wanted to say. Okay. One more before I get to the 21 centimeter. It's very important that when we do it, we can forget about the n equal 2 and the n equal 3 and the n equal 4 levels. We can consider only the n equal 1 level and say, oh, that's just a 4-level system. Okay. To a good approximation, we can forget about everything else, and it's a very, very good approximation. And then there's actually two time scales that emerge when we do the hydrogen atom. Okay. One time scale that emerges is the delta E. Okay, it's the difference between the two states. And we know it's very small. It's the energy of the triplet minus the energy of the... And here it's energy, you know. For us, it's always mass. But, you know, come back to this old day that we did non-relativistic quantum mechanics. All they have the energy there. Okay, but of course, in the relativistic case, wherever they're E, they're going to be M. So we have energy splitting between the singlet, and this is the famous 21-centimeter line. Okay, and it's very small. Okay, I mean 21 centimeters, something like 10^-6 electron volt, and you know the energy is 13.6 eV. So we are talking about 10^-7 suppression or something like this. And this 10^-7 suppression is very easy to understand. It's alpha squared times mE over mp. So that's alpha squared is 10^-4, and mE over mp is another 10^-3. So that's the 10^-7. NDA works. Okay, it's really nice. So I have one scale is the splitting, and the other scale is the lifetime of the triplet, okay? The lifetime of the triplet is the triplet going to the singlet times the photon. And this lifetime is, I'm sure you all knew it. Anybody remember it by chance? We all, for sure, when you study quantum mechanics, someone mentioned it to you. It's 10 million years, okay? So the lifetime of the 21 centimeter is about 10 million years. So that's clearly much, much smaller than the splitting itself, right? So the splitting itself is 21 centimeters, and I don't know in length what is 10 million years, but it's definitely, you know, much, much smaller. So you see that I produced two new scales here, okay? The splitting and the lifetime, okay? So I guess you remember this kind. Is it, it rings the bell, or it's like, yes? I know, it's been so long, right? I mean, lucky me, I was teaching it like a few years ago.
The bell is not.
Not very hard. Now, one thing that actually people probably didn't tell you when you were in undergrad and you studied the hyperfine splitting is the following, that this delta E has to do with the spin of the proton. Okay, so if you take the spin of the proton, that I know I have a proton spin up, and I put an electron in, the time scale to lose the spin polarization is the time scale of delta E. Makes sense? Because in the beginning, when you have spin up an electron, a spin up of the proton is not an energy eigenstate once you put the electron in, okay? And it starts oscillate between the triplet and the singlet. And once you fully oscillate between singlet and the triplet, you lose the spin information. Okay? So there's something that has to do with the hyperfine splitting that usually we don't teach. Okay? But you see why the proton, the spin. The polarization of the proton, the time it takes until the proton becomes unpolarized when you put an electron nearby, is delta E. Make sense? Okay, so that's the important thing. Okay? So now let's consider some initial state of the hydrogen atom. I take a hydrogen atom with proton spin up, and I put the electron spin down. Okay? This is a superposition of triplet and a singlet. 50% triplet, 50% singlet. Okay? So this state starts oscillate. Okay? And this oscillation, the spin. The oscillation frequency is delta E. So what's happened? At very short times, the spin of the proton is still spin up. Okay? At very, very long time, it's completely become 50% triplets, 50% singlet, and it's the 1-0 and 0-0 state. And the 1-0 and 0-0 state, in both of them, the top, on average, have no polarization. It's kind of very intuitive. You put something in the magnetic field, and when it's oscillate very, when it's moved very fast, on average, it's no zero polarization. Okay?
If you double the time, it will come back.
That's only when you have very, very precise measurement. But you know always that at the end of the day, what we really think about is that you measure it at an arbitrary numbers. So you're absolutely right that if I have a way to track it to the second peak, I can do it. But the picture that I like to have in mind is that I have some time, which is going to be the lifetime, and the lifetime probe it at different points. So if I wait long enough and I probe it arbitrary, on average, I get zero. If I have a mechanism to make sure that I probe it after 2 pi, you know, after really, then it becomes 1 again, okay? And of course, there's also the issue of decoherence, ta-ta-ta, that we don't going to get into it, but that's the work we have, okay? So the depolarization timescale for the proton in the hydrogen atom in a plus minus is the 21 centimeter, okay? That's the delta E. Now what's happening if I start my proton in a plus-plus situation? So my proton is spin up and my electron is spin up. They will stay because this is an energy eigenstate. It will stay like this forever, almost, until the triplet will decay into the singlet. Once the triplet decay into a singlet, I have the photon going out, but the proton spin become completely unpolarized because it's a singlet. Okay, the singlet is completely unpolarized. Okay? So here the lifetime, here the depolarization time is the triplet lifetime. Okay? So we see the following, that there's two kind of time scale that tells you how the polarization is losing. If I start in a plus minus situation, then the depolarization time scale is delta E. If I start in a plus plus, the depolarization time scale is the width of the triplet to singlet. Okay? These are the two time scale, and it depends on your initial state. Okay? Good.
But so the singlet, the triplet n equal to zero state not decaying to the singlet through a photon emission, can it?
No, of course it can, right? I mean, it just depends which direction you go.
Oh, but you meet in a n equal to one state.
Yes. So it depends on directionality. So the lifetime is the same, right? You don't care about the what is called the MZ quantum number for the lifetime. So back to the LHC, and I need to do almost nothing since now that you really remember the hyperfine splitting of the hydrogen atom, it's really, there's so much physics in the hyperfine splitting of the hydrogen atom. Once you know that you recall it all and you're excited again, all you have to do is just, whenever I said proton, said top. So let me say the following. I think about a top-like new particle that I still call it a top. So it could be a T prime or something like this. So I say top, and it doesn't have to be the real top. It's something that looks like the real top, with the lifetime is a parameter, okay? And I like to measure the lifetime of this particle. And basically, I almost do, it's like the hydrogen atom. Instead of a proton, I said top. Instead of the electron, I said the brown mark or the light quark in the meson or something like this, okay? And instead of QED, I have QCD. In QED, I can calculate. In QCD, it's a little harder, but I'm going to tell you that I can also know how to calculate in QCD, and that's basically the same. You see the analog? You see that the heavy top with a light U around it, it looks very much like a heavy proton with a light electron around it. And instead of QED, 1 over R potential here, I still have some other central potential. The point is that it's central potential. Once it's a central potential, all this kind of, you know, triplet, singlet, and all this is the same. And the other difference is there we call energy, and here we call mass. Okay? So, we assume that the mass of the top is known. It's not the real top, but we will measure it by now. But then, and then what's happening? We're going to have two kind of states. We have the triplet and the singlet. In the meson language, we call it B and B star for the B meson. And for the top, we would have called it a T and a T star. So a T, it's kind of a misuse of the name because the T is the singlet, right? And the T star is the triplet. And usually in the hydrogen atom, T is the triplet. But I hope this is the ground state and this is the excited state. Okay, so this is the singlet state and this is the triplet state. And then we say, what are the timescales that might top loss this polarization? The timescale has to do with these two timescales, delta M and gamma. Okay? Delta M is the timescale that the kind of the top, the, you know, when I produce a spin with top, it's oscillate between a T and a T star. Okay, so if I start with this kind of situation with spin of the top up, spin of the U down, it's a superposition of T and a T star. So the top loose polarization after time scale of delta M. And the other time scale is the width, which is a T star go to T gamma width, which is just like the 21 centimeter emission. Okay, it's the T star go to T gamma. Do you see that this, it is the same? Yes, yes.
Is there a reason why we know for sure that all is for mesons rather than baryons?
No, actually, I'm going to get there, and we know experimentally that about 10% of the time it produces baryon. So to good approximation, it produces meson 90% of the time. So I will go back to the baryons at the end. I will make a remark. So for now, for simplicity, let's assume that we produce a meson. And you're absolutely right. That's a difference. In the hydrogen atom, there's no way you can produce baryons in a sense. That's because...
But presumably some analogous story holds there as well.
Actually, not really. We'll get there, okay? We'll get there. Let me come... We'll get there. Let's first explain this. Now, the point is, what I want to say, the difference between the hydrogen atom, you just take the Schrödinger equation, not the Bohr model, it's the Schrödinger equation. You put it in, and you get some numbers out, right? Here you cannot do it. Why? Because QCD is strong. But we have some scaling law, and we have heavy quark effective theory that tells me how these are scaled, okay? And we know that delta M scale like 1 over M, and we know that this width scale like 1 over M cubed. And we measure, basically, I'm going to tell you that we measure it at the B scale. Since we measure it at the B scale, we know how it is at the top scale. Okay? It's basically well-known properties of QCD. If you measure it at one point, you know how it runs to any other point. Okay? You don't have to calculate. If you measure at one point and you know how things run, it's enough. Okay? You don't have to calculate for first principles. Okay? So, basically, we know how we get delta M and gamma. And then we're kind of done, okay? I hope you see the point. We know these time scales, and then all we have to do is to measure this polarization.
But okay? The atomization time scale is one
of the... I love it, you know. Oh, it's like... it's the second time this talk today that, you know, you want to say something, it's like exactly the next thing I want to say. So I want you to think about three time scales all in all. Lambda QCD is when hadronization happens, and that's really the time scale that you can forget about all this n equal 2, n equal 3, n equal 4. After lambda QCD, you hadronize, but you don't know if you are a T or a T star. Okay, you see the point. When I say, oh, after lambda QCD I hadronize, it's very important. It's not that you fully hadronize. After lambda QCD, you hadronize only when the difference is lambda QCD, like the different ends. But within a multiplet, the T and the T star are what we call a heavy quark spin multiplet, we really don't know where we are, okay? So after time scale of lambda QCD, we don't know, we are still in a superposition of T and the T star. But we know we are not in whatever it's called, a T1 or something, okay? Then after time scale of order delta M, we start kind of know if we are a T or a T star because we oscillate enough. And when we oscillate enough, kind of the oscillation average out, and you know if you're a T or a T star. You kind of hadronize into a T or a T star, and only very, very late, the T star decay into a T, and then I know all I have is just at the ground state. And only then this ground state can eventually decay weakly. Okay? So in a B meson, that's the case. In a B meson, the weak decay is much, much after this. Okay? So a B meson goes through all these four stages. It starts as a B quark, it's hadronized, and it's still a superposition of a B and a B star. After some lifetime of all, after delta M, it's either a B star or a B. And then eventually the B star decay into a B and emit a photon. And then we have the B meson. And then this B meson decay weakly. For the new particle, we don't know when the weak decay is going to happen. The weak decay is some other, and that's where the lifetime, where we are after. We're after the weak lifetime. So it can happen at any stage. It can happen before lambda QCD, between those, and between those. Okay? And any of those, we kind of lose some amount of polarization if we start in a polarized case. Okay? So let's see what's really happened for us. So the top actually produced, say, and that's a big if. I will get to there. But let's assume that I know that the top is produced spin-up. Okay, it's a big if, but bear with me. I assume I know that the top is produced with spin-up. And I also assume that I can measure the final top polarization. Okay? Now, what's really happened to the for the top? Since QCD is partly conserving, the top is produced with spin up, and then 50% of the time, the light quark will couple like this, and 50% of the time, it's coupled like this, okay? Okay, so basically, I have incoherent sum of 50% plus plus and 50% plus minus, okay? Now, plus plus is a mass eigenstate, so the plus plus is just a 1-1, okay? And the plus minus is a superposition of these two, of a 1-0 and a 0-0, okay? So what would happen now after it's evolved in time? After it's evolved in time, basically the following happened. This state, the plus plus, depolarized a time scale of 1 over lambda, okay? Because only when the T star decaying to T, only then you lose polarization, okay? The plus minus lose polarization after lifetime of order delta n, okay? So overall, the time that this is kind of the one of the master formulas, I say the polarization as a function of time is half of my depolarized cosine delta mt because of the oscillation, and half of it depolarized at time scale of this width. Okay? So I hope it's clear. I start with top spin up, it's polarized, it's hadronized, half of them depolarize at time scale delta m, and half of them depolarize at time scale of the lifetime of this T star. Very good. Of course, we cannot really follow the lifetime. If we could follow, then we don't need all this method. We can measure the lifetime. The only thing we can do is time integration, right? We just see okay, we just look at the particle after it decays. So, in practically, we have to do time integration. And I define the following parameter that I call R, where R is the ratio between the final polarization over the initial polarization. So, of course, if all the polarization lost, R is 0. If no polarization lost, R is 1. Okay? And then we can do this calculation. We just take the integral of what I have before over time, and we get this kind of simple expression, where X is delta M over gamma, and Y is the width over the gamma. So this gamma is the weak width. That's the lifetime of the particle that's come from our new physics model. That's really what we want to measure. We want to measure this width. Okay? This width is the width of the T star go to T gamma. I told you we know. Okay? So basically, that's the whole point. We can measure R. I told you, we know the initial polarization and we measure the final polarization. So we measure R. Okay? We know delta M and gamma from theory. And then you just plug it into here and you see the only unknown is the lifetime. Okay? So that's basically the idea. Oh, yeah. So I use X and Y because in deep physics we call it X and Y. Yeah. That's right. But, at the end of the day, oscillation is the same no matter what. You start with a state, the state starts oscillate, and then you do integral, you're always going to get this. Okay? So that's the point. The point is you start with some spin up, and the question how long it takes it to have less spin, less polarization, and it's clear that it's these two time scales. Okay? Yes?
So gamma sub gamma?
Yes.
Suppose that thing is very long, then you're guaranteed you always see polarization effects.
That's right. But I'm going to tell you that actually this one is roughly 10 to the minus 2. The width of this is 10 to the minus 2. So the lifetime is actually 10 to the minus 14 seconds. So it's not very long for a top like quark. Okay? So it's actually kind of, So you would think, it's 10 million years. So it's 10. We know what it is, okay? It's really electromagnetism. And you would say, it's then the 10 million years. But the 10 million years for the hydrogen atom. For the top light, we're going to get the numbers soon. Okay, so now I'm telling you that those two numbers actually are within the problematic region. So that's kind of where all this come together. You plot it as a function and you see. When the lifetime is large, when we have short lifetime with large width, basically you completely polarize, you stay your polarization. Then after a lifetime of, say, after some delta M, delta M is like 1 MeV, you go down here, and then after a longer lifetime, you lose polarization completely, okay? So that's kind of, you see when I say taking the window and divide it by 3, that's basically, okay? If I'm here, I have 1, half, or 0, okay? And if I'm really lucky and I'm 0.3, then I really measure the lifetime, okay? But if I'm not very lucky and I get half, then I'm in kind of this plateau, okay? So in principle, in some places, I can really measure the lifetime if I'm lucky, and if not, I can only break it into 3 kind of sub-windows, okay? So that's basically all I really wanted to say. Now I'm going to get into the details that are, you know, much more dirty. So I have 10 more minutes to get to the dirty stuff. But that's one, it's really where I kind of like it, because there's so much, like, it's just trivial quantum mechanics that tells you how you can really use these trivial quantum mechanics to get sensitivity in lifetime in a place that you didn't expect. Okay, so let's go on to the details. And I'm going to be a little bit more fast here. And first, I told you, oh, you know, we know how to calculate this delta M, okay? And basically, it's just heavy quark effective theory. And the idea of heavy quark effective theory, just to kind of remind the point, is that if you have a color source that is very heavy, to a good approximation, the light degrees of freedom don't really care. And the good analogy is like, you know, if you take a hydrogen atom and a deuterium, you don't really care. The energy levels are almost the same, okay? Again, coming back to your undergrad life, what is the, there's two differences between a hydrogen and deuterium. One difference is the reduced mass, you remember? So that changed the energy level. And the other is the hyperfine interaction, because in the hydrogen atom is half-half, and in the deuterium is half times zero, so you don't have hyperfine splitting for deuterium. Okay? So there's two effects, the fact that it has a finite mass, the proton, okay? But these are very, very small effects. So actually, we know how to calculate this effect from heavy quark effective theory. And in heavy quark effective theory, this parameter is called lambda 2, okay? And this lambda 2 is a parameter that has to do with the difference between the mass of the B star and the mass of the B. And we know that it's scale like 1 over M, and we know how it runs, actually, okay? So people calculate it to 2-loop, the running of this coupling. So this lambda 2 is just some coupling in some effective theory, and I measure it at MB, and all I need to do is run it now to M top, okay? And, you know, you put the two loop running, it's for sure good enough for us, okay? So when you plug numbers, and you plug, just choose the real top, so I choose 170, and I plug in the running, I get the delta M is 1 MeV. Okay, so that's the number that come out. And I want to emphasize that this number has to do only with the fact that we know that I can use heavy quark effective theory. I don't need to calculate in QCD. I can measure in one point, and then QCD tell me how this is related to anything in any other point. Okay, so in QED, you always think, oh, I really need to calculate at one point. I really need to calculate the hydrogen atom. No, we don't. It's enough to measure it like in one hydrogen, and then you know how it is in deuterium and how it is in tritium, and this kind of thing. The only assumption that we used here is the fact that this particle is colored triplet. Okay? So in principle, if my top was not spin half, this delta M would be the same. Okay? I don't know if it's... Delta M, the energy doesn't care about this kind of the splitting.
But if it was a different color...
Of course, if I have only spin zero, I don't have a splitting at all between the two states, okay? What I meant is that
there's some scaling on this
spectrum. Yes.
Right? But it's just a
number. Yes, the number is nothing. The number lambda 2, of course, the spectrum depends on the spin. But what I want to say is that this lambda 2, the running of lambda 2 only is important only that it's a triplet. The other thing I told you we need to know is this lifetime of the hyperfine state that has to do with the, you know, triplet going to singlet and the photon. Here, this is really, we can use heavy quark effective theory, but not as good as we want. Because this really has to do with the, what we call the Brown mark. It's really that you take the kind of the light degrees of freedom change, the So we cannot really use heavy quark effective theory, and you use some models. And for some reason, experimental reason, you really cannot measure the width for the B. You can measure the width for the D. So for the D, we know how to we measure the width. And to a good approximation, this width is independent on the mass of the heavy guy. Okay? Again, if you think about the hydrogen atom, and you have some N2 going to N1, you don't care if it's a proton or a deuterium, right? To a good approximation. So if I measure it for the D, in principle, it's valid everywhere. The problem is that the D is not heavy enough, okay? The mass of the charm, you know, the D meson is like 1.9, 1.8, and lambda QCD is... So the correction, the fact that the charm is not heavy enough, the correction are very important, okay? So you have to put some model to say, oh, what are the correction to the fact that the charm is not heavy enough? And you have to put this correction and then kind of start running it up, okay? So we know it to some 10, 20% uncertainty. And what I'm saying that if we find this particle and we do everything and all we need is a better precision for this, you know, people will jump into it. There's just some calculation that has to be done. Okay?
Sorry, can you say again, what's the role of the deuterium particle?
Yes. So the point is that's actually a very interesting story. So for the charm, you know, so the question is what is more important? This star going to d pi or this star going to d gamma. So if you just look at the coupling, of course, this star going to d pi going to win because that's strong. So this is a strong decay and this is electromagnetic decay. So strong decays always win over electromagnetism. Okay. However, there's a phase space effect. Okay. And the phase space, this star going to d gamma, the much, much larger space phase than this star going to d pi. Okay. So for example, in the B case, all you have is B star going to B gamma because that's the only thing that you can have from phase space. Now, in the charm, it's just complete accident that both of them are the same. If you change the mass of the charm a little bit, one of them would be completely dominant. And actually, I don't remember now the numbers, but we can open the PDG. So you have also D plus and D zero and pi plus and pi zero. And you see that some of them, one of them is dominant and the other. But in some of them, they are like, you know, really all the one. So the phase space... Okay, so the coupling is really like the D star going to D pi. The coupling is much bigger than the, but the phase space kind of stand exactly to make them both the same. Okay, so this is really making all this measurement possible to measure the widths. Okay.
So what's measured is the total D star width.
Yes.
And the branching fraction of these two.
Yes. Okay, and that's something that. And because it's kind of large enough, you can do it. And they see the problem is as follows that. For the B, you cannot do it because it's only decay to photon and the width is too narrow. If the charm was a little bit, if we have a little bit more phase space, all I could do is D star going to D pi. So because I can still do D star to D pi, the width is large enough, but because it just happened, I can also do the D star to D gamma. So it's kind of luck that they are the same. Okay? So when I put some numbers, oh, I forgot to mention one thing. To a good approximation, this decay of the depend this is just electromagnetic decay, so it's proportional to the charge of the light quark squared. So the difference between U and D is a factor of 4 in lifetime, just because it's the electric charge squared. Okay. So actually, I don't have only two timescales. I have a little more timescales. Okay. So if you plug in number, what do you find? You find that for the top, delta M is for the 1 MeV. The decay for U, it's 10 to the minus 2 electron volt, and the decay for the D is 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3 electron volt. Okay, this factor of 4 is just the electric charge squared. So, of course, with the U, it decay faster than with the D. Okay? So this is really nice because all these numbers are within my problematic region. Okay? It doesn't have to be the case, okay? Actually, if I take my mass to be like 300 MeV, 300 GeV, because this K like one of the mass to the cube, then these two get out of my problematic region. So for heavy guys, like a 500 GeV, top only the first one is within the problematic region. The other two are already too long. And that's what you mentioned before, okay? Bions, as Itai said, there's also a probability to hadronize into a baryon. And we know from Z data, and B data. So we look at how B are hadronized in Z decay at LEP. And we know that roughly the ratio is 4-4-1-1. And the fact that these two are the same, we understand from isospin. B up and B, you know, producing up or down is isospin. The fact that B sub S and lambda B are roughly the same is complete accident. There's no reason for B sub S to be the same. So in B sub S, you have to pop up an S from the vacuum, and for a lambda B, you have to pop up a QQ from the vacuum. And so one is separate because S is heavier, and the other is separate because you have to pop up two quarks from the vacuum rather than one, and this separation happened to be 25% for both. Okay, just. So when you plug it all together, what's happened is the following. When I have a baryon, the spin of the top is up, but the QQ spin is a spin zero. So then I don't have any hyperfine splitting, and there's no depolarization at all. So if I produce a top with spin up that hadronizes into a baryon, it will stay like this until it's weakly decayed. Okay? So basically, this is really nice because I will never really go to zero. When I go to zero, you start to worry, well, maybe it's not a spin at all. Maybe it's just a scalar. Okay? But here, I know that even that I will go down to 10%. So when I produce a top with spin up, even if I wait long enough, at the end, 10% guaranteed to be there. Okay, so that's kind of make it nicer. Okay. So I kind of run out of time. There's some challenges that I kind of mentioned throughout, so let me go very quickly on them. All this assumption, we have to know the spin and the representation, so you know, I kind of assume that I know that it's a top-like particle. That's an assumption. It's much more complicated when I have other things. So, of course, the naive thing is to start, oh, let's do gluinos. But gluinos are, you know, they are spin half, but they are, you know, they are octets. So I don't know exactly how they hadronize. So all this picture, this nice picture that I was telling you, that I really know how to calculate delta M and this gamma, is not so clear for gluinos, for example. That would be kind of ideal for this kind of, you know, it's a nice.
Well, you have this like 12 order of magnitude window, right? So at some level, if you just have NDA answers for the gluino,
that's right. So actually for gluino, yeah, that's right. I know. So, you know, you take some model of QCD, and a model of QCD is very easy. You say, oh, I have an octet, and it's scale like the second Casimir squared, and I do some linear potential of QCD, and you get a number that is some factor of two wrong from the real one, right? So, yeah, so we can do it, but, you know, it is kind of a challenge. The point would be as follows. If we find this particle and we find the gluino and we see that the gluino long live and we do this polarization, all we need is just theory calculation. Come on, someone will do it, right? I mean, it's a bit premature now to do all this big calculation, but if it will be needed, we can have it, okay?
What do you mean if the ground state is a singlet, there's no hyperfine?
Oh, what I want to say is that if it's a singlet of SU3 color, all this, there's nothing. Of course, this method works only.
Yeah.
So you know, the other problem is the initial polarization. You don't know. But what I didn't tell you, and this is something that we are doing now, is that we don't really need to know the polarization. It's enough to use some correlation. So I want to think about some TT bar production and use correlation. And the same kind of similar story goes there. We didn't fully do it yet, but I hope we will finish it. But it's the same idea. You use some TT bar correlation, and according to the lifetime, you lose the correlation. So if I have TT bar, if I have stop, there's no correlation because it's spin zero. And if I have like KK top with a KK top, I have correlation. And this kind of, the hadronization kind of move you from one to the other. So you start from half and kind of go to zero. And if one top hadronizes like this and the other top hadronizes like this, then you start with both of them spin like this. Then after kind of relatively fast time, one of them depolarizes and the other is not depolarized, and eventually both depolarize. Okay? So this is kind of thing that people didn't do because usually you kind of, if you start with, you either have half or, so we are doing this. But we can do this. I mean, so the initial polarization is just to explain things, but in practice we look for correlation. And we didn't do it yet, but it is the same.
Okay.
Measuring the polarization, as always, we know it's a big deal, but many other people work on this. So, you know, I guess Itai can give a whole talk about how to do this. But it's a problem that is not only our problem, so that's nice. Everybody else, so eventually it will be solved, okay? You know, there's other people to worry. My last remark is that, you know, we here we use only the polarization, but basically you can do other timescales, some flavor timescales. So if we know that there's some other quantum number, we can do the same tricks. So we produce some meson that have some flavor eigenstate that for in this specific model have some relaxation time, we can actually do it also with others. Okay? That's one example that is the polarization. But the basic idea of some other timescale can work. We have some idea of lepton numbers, so I can do it with neutrinos. That I produce a neutrino or smuon, and this smuon oscillates into a selectron. And within a specific SUSY model, I know the time is there for this smuon to oscillate to this selectron. And I can measure the lifetime of this smuon and selectron within this specific framework. Okay? But you see the idea. Okay, so I guess that's really when I want to conclude, as you know, using polarization measurements, we can get some information of lifetime using this quantum mechanics. And probably, you know, we need luck to find this particle. I mean, otherwise, we all need it for whatever model building we're doing. Okay, thanks.
Can we go back to the baryon story?
Yes, coming back to the baryon.
Can you explain again why you would never depolarize?
Yes. So the idea is as follows. So the ground state of this is the lambda. Okay. So you have to come back again. You know, when you look at the baryons, the lambda is the one where the heavy guy is spin half and the light degrees of freedom is spin zero. You have some mixing with this, with the sigma, and the sigma is one and one. Okay, but the point is that the mass difference between those is very, very large. So practically, very quickly, practically of all the lambda QCD, you're down at the lambda. And then the lambda, you have half times the, and the light degrees of freedom are zero. So there's no hyperfine splitting. Okay, so since there's no hyperfine splitting, you stay spin half all the time. Okay, so it could have been, if for some reason you end up with a one, you know, like half times half gives you half plus three halves. And if they were very close, you can have some mixing, but they are not very close, they are far away. They're just really this.
That's great.
Hmm?
That's great.
It's nice. Yeah, so it's nice that you say, oh, you know, it's ideally, that it's not like, it's a, so you find that you see some polarizations at stake.
I don't have a question about production, yes. So I don't know if you've seen this paper by Park a while ago, I think from the 90s.
I think it's with Yael. There's one with Yael, with Shadmi, Park and Shadmi, and one that he did.
Another one where he just talks about correlation PP bar.
Yes. So yeah, I know these papers.
So, but I thought part of the problem was that in LHC, you're starting to be completely gluon dominated, and then there are two different diagrams that can give that. One is an S channel, and the other are two T channels.
Yes.
And I think the correlation is only in the S channel.
Yes, so yeah, so as I said, we work on it and we try to be like how practical it is. So what we try to do now is that, okay, so, and I do it with Maxim because Maxim really know how to run simulation. Like, I mean, I cannot go and do like, but you know,
so Maxim
Pernstein, yes, yeah,
I should have.
I know, I should have said. Okay, so with Maxim Pernstein, he know how to run simulation. So what we try to do, we take a fourth generation model, and in the fourth generation model we have VTB, VT prime B. So we take the B or the T or whatever we like, one of the lightest of the T prime and the B prime decay into a standard model on the three generation. And if the T prime is kind of, if the mixing between the fourth generation and the first three is very, very small, you have a gauge. Okay? So we kind of play with it and start putting and see how much you can see. Okay? And it's true. Once you start doing it in a realistic thing, you start losing a lot. But I mean, the point is that this kind of thing is not unique for us. So, you know, once you will find this kind of new thing, people will fight so much to really do this spin measurement and this correlation measurement. And we just kind of use all what they do. So if yeah, so, you know, if it's a problem, then it's a problem for everybody. I don't know if, I don't know if that's a good answer, that, you know, everybody has the same problem. It's not our problem. We kind of, if everybody can do it, we just add something on it, right? If we can, the point, if we can do spin measurement, we can do this lifetime measurement. If we cannot do spin measurement, we cannot do this lifetime measurement. That's my point. Yeah, yeah.
But measuring correlations is always harder than just measuring the overall spin.
Yes, I know. Yeah, yeah. So you can. So yeah. So it's true that what I meant is measuring this kind of polarization. Yeah, but it's true that there's other ways to measure spin that is not that would not help us.
Well, just if you have some distribution that can tell you the spin cumulatively, but if it's distinguishing uses the polarization but can't resolve it up by that,
but
that's useless.
But he doesn't need to resolve it up by
that. Well, he needs to correlate.
The two stuff.
That's right. So that's which makes
it
hard. If you have something that sort of
has
poor resolving power, then that poor resolving power gets in some sense squared.
Right, but I think the hardness here is just the fact that you don't always have correlation in production. I think if the production is, like, for example, it's only S channel,
we're okay. So
then it's really just the same problem as the correlation itself.
It's the set is measuring the correlation.
Right, I'm not saying in his case, yeah, right. So in S-channel, it's really the same as measuring the correlation. The extra problem here is that it's not always S-channel, especially not when it's following.
So what I want to say is that it's boiled down to this. It's boiled down to how practical it is.
Right.
So, you know, this is like, this is the idea is there. Now, practically, you know, there are ideas that, you know, they are there, but practically when you start putting it all together, you just lose sensitivity and we just say, sorry, it won't work. So that's, I don't know much about, and that's what I say. We started to look into this and we are going very slow. So I don't have much to say about beside the fact that, actually, I'd be happy to hear more if you did more on this. And I know I talked with Itai before on similar.
Once you can try to look at the production, I don't know if anyone ever does or if it works, but there is just an overall between the two sides, there is some difference between the T-channel and S-channel. So in the S-channel, they tend to be more central, just because you don't have a singularity in the T-channel.
Okay, I see.
So maybe if you can play some cuts on how central they are, you tend to be more sensitive to the S-channel, in which case you know you have more.
I'd be happy, you know, I'd be happy to talk on this more. We still have a few hours. And, you know, we can finish the paper today. But, you know, that's really the point. The point is how to think about all these little tricks that make it realistic. And that's a whole new thing that I really want to do. I mean, I think doing it, make it realistic, it's a big step. Because, you know, can we do it or not? So I don't know. I hope we can.
All right, okay. You have no time to do this.